Last week we were concerned with the poetry of Robinson Jeffers. This week we'll be concerned with another West Coast poet. West Coast, San Francisco, California, Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder. Snyder was born in San Francisco in 1930. On both sides of his family, he had farmers and workers. He grew up on a farm on the Pacific Northwest Coast. On the Northwest Coast, and around the age of 15, he says somewhere, he became a disciple of Mount St. Helens. And he was later to become a disciple, to study under many other great mountains, just as he studied many books and looked for masters. 1947, at age 17 then, he enrolled at Reed College, where he studied Amerindian oral literature, mainly tribes of the Northwest. He graduated from Reed College in 1951. Thereafter, he studied linguistics at Indiana University. And then finally at Berkeley, California, he studied Far Eastern languages. So you have Amerindian oral literature, anthropology, literary anthropology, then linguistics, then Far Eastern languages, and that meant Chinese and Japanese. He also studied, similar in this to Robinson Jeffers, forestry in the Cascades and in the Sierra Nevada. During the summers, like many of his fellow poet students also, he undertook various vacation jobs at sea or in the woods. And at one point, 1955-56, he decided to leave America in order to go more deeply into Buddhist studies in Japan. And he lived in Japan, mostly in Japan, with breaks, between 1956 and 1968. He came back to America, to the States, in 1968. At present, he's living among what you might call forest beatniks in the California mountains, with a Japanese wife and two sons. Let's look at them, first of all, in this poem, Nooksack Valley. Nooksack Valley, written February 1956, just before he left for Japan, where he's looking over his own life, seeing his path as lived up to then in America, and looking at the possible path ahead. Nooksack Valley. At the far end of a trip north, in a berry picker's cabin at the edge of a wide, muddy field stretching to the woods and cloudy mountains, feeding the stove all afternoon with cedar, watching the dark sky darken, a heron flap by, a huge setter pup nap on a dusty cot. High rotten stumps in the second growth woods, flat scattered farms in the bends of the Nooksack River. Steelhead run now a week, and I go back down 99 through towns to San Francisco and Japan. All America, south and east, 25 years in it, brought to a trip stop, Mine Point, where I turn, caught more on this land, rock, tree, and man, awake than ever before, yet ready to leave. Damned memories, whole wasted theories, failures and worse success. Schools, girls, deals try to get in to make this poem a froth, a pity, a dead fiddle for lost good jobs. The cedar walls, smell of our farmhouse, half built in 35. Clouds sink down the hills, coffee's hot again. The dog turns and turns about, stops and sleeps. There you have Snyder in his home country, if you like, which is very much backcountry America, in a specific place. Specific places are important. Nooksack Valley, a particular locality. He's up there at the end of a trip, at the end of something, on an edge, which is a mind point. It's not only the end of a trip, it's also a point of concentration, a point of perspective. Before you enter into that perspective, you have details, practical details, simply an eye looking round at what surrounds him, taking in the ambience, taking in the surrounding reality with various details, watching the dark sky darken, a heron flap by, etc. And then you have the beginning of the, let's not call it a program, but let's say the path opening out before him. The path which will consist in leaving America, where he has achieved a certain amount of wakefulness, where he has, his mind has become awake, more awake, as he says, yet ready to leave because he wants a further realization, a further clarification, as a desire for an even deeper deliverance, shall we say, or deconditioning. And then, after opening this path, he comes back to the immediate reality around him. He never loses sight of the immediate reality, however much he indulges in perspectives, however much he tries to see the path opening out. The immediate reality is still there, and it begins with simply the cedar walls of the cabin in which he's staying, with a little reminiscence thrown in, smell as a farmhouse, half built in 35. There's no definite purpose to keep the poem absolutely pure. He throws that reminiscence in, just off the cuff, as it were, and then the general perspective, the general surrounding countryside, clouds sink down the hills, coffee's hot again, the dog turns and turns about, stops and sleeps, back to absolute, immediate, ordinary reality. Snyder is usually tied in with the so-called Beat Generation. I say so-called, not because the term is false, but because it's simply, well, useful but journalistic. Eh? Who wants to be jammed into a generation of any kind? You want to be freer than that, but it's okay. It's useful as a journalistic term at most. Let's use it for the moment. Kerouac, in his book Desolation Angels, apropos of a night at the Jazz Cellar in San Francisco, gives you a fast introduction to his usage of the word beat. I would rather talk about the beat movement than the beat generation, you know. The beat movement. So here's his, Kerouac's, definition of the word beat. In one crazy swinging sentence, the kind of sentences he likes. Jack Kerouac then, it's the beat generation, it's bear, it's the beat to keep, it's the beat of the heart, it's being beat and down in the world and like old time low down and like in ancient civilizations. So it's the beat generation. It's Bea. Don't forget that Jack Kerouac, who is, shall we say, the foremost figure in this group, not to say the leader of the group that comprises Jack Kerouac, Gary Snyder, Allen Ginsberg, and several others. It's the beat generation. It's Bea. Don't forget that Jack Kerouac was of French-Canadian origin. Hence Bea. You know, he does have French at the tip of his tongue, as it were. It's Bea. So beat generation for him means a kind of beatitude, and beatitude, bea. It's the beat to keep. Another aspect of the beat is rhythm, mainly jazz rhythm. It's the beat to keep. It's the beat of the heart. There's something physical and physiological about it. It's the beat of the heart. It's being beat and down in the world, beat in the sense of down and out. It's being beat and down in the world, and like old-time lowdown, and like in ancient civilizations, and there's a further thing thrown in, it's something ancient, it's something which happens down the ages. All the connotations then of the word beat in one typical swinging sentence. Let's look at this beat movement. It largely meant a migration of the American mind from east to west. Kerouac and Ginsberg were both brought up in the East, on the East Coast, and it was when they went west to San Francisco they met up with Gary Snyder, and the so-called beat generation, the beat movement, began. In a sense, you could see the whole of American literature moving from East to West. American literature began on the Atlantic seaboard, in New England, and Boston, and then New York. And then, you might say, it's schematical, but it's not untrue. You might say that in the 1920s, at the beginning of the 20th century, force tended to move to Chicago, to the Middle West, with poets like Carl Sandburg. and a big poetry review called Chicago, the Chicago Review, Poetry Review. So 1920s, it was Chicago. And then by the 1950s, you're into San Francisco, moving a bit further south later into Los Angeles. Roughly the movement of American literature from its beginning, say, 1820 to 1950. San Francisco had been a kind of literary capital before. In a book which I recommend, The Times of Melville and Whitman, by a man called Van Wyck Brooks, he says this with regard to San Francisco. With magazines and libraries increasing through the war years, the Civil War years, San Francisco had become the literary capital of all the vast country west of the plains and the mountains. There, a singular group of writers arose and flourished for a while. Others appeared and joined them as birds of passage. There were then writers in San Francisco. There was a literary center there. But with the Beat Movement, you're concerned with something more than a literary group or a literary center. You're concerned with a whole mystical, poetical, social movement, much more than a literary group or a literary circle. Kerouac, again in typical language, speaks of my poetic, Zen, lunatic, Dharma bum friends in San Francisco. My poetic, Zen, lunatic, Dharma bum friends in San Francisco. My poetic, okay, up to there it's easy. Zen Buddhism. Lunatic, okay. Dharma is an old Sanskrit word meaning the root of things, the fundamental law. And a Dharma bum is somebody who is an outcast from society. He's a bum. He's beat, separated from society, the way a tramp or a bum is outside of society, but outside of society into the fundamental reality of the universe, the Dharma. Dharma bum, friends in San Francisco. My poetic, Zen lunatic, Dharma bum friends in San Francisco. With regard to the Beat group as a whole, Snyder is very much a bird of passage. I mean, he is part of it for a time, but he moves through it. His trajectory goes beyond anything, especially anything like a Beat generation, and goes even beyond the Beat movement. Even Kerouac, who was the spokesman for this group, the inventor of this group, who sold more blue jeans than anybody, you know, because blue jeans were part of the thing. Even Kerouac got a bit fed up pretty soon with Beat attitudes. I mean, people who just sort of joined the gang and pretended, if you like, or took on all the attitudes of the Beat movement, having no real awareness or sense of what it was really about, and no impetus in their own makeup to further any of the program, any of the plans, any of the perspectives. Well, it was at a poetry evening in San Francisco that this Beat movement began, or what you might call the one of the most important aspects of it, which was the San Francisco Poetry Renaissance. Kerouac meets Snyder, or if you like, Ray Smith meets Jaffe Ryder. Ray Smith is a character in Kerouac's book, The Dharma Bums, and it's very much a self-portrait. Ray Smith, then, is Kerouac, and he meets Jaffe Ryder, which is obviously a pseudonym for Gary Snyder. Ray Smith, then, meets Jaffe Ryder. Jack Kerouac meets Gary Snyder, and here's what Kerouac says about Snyder, about that night, first of all. Everyone was there. It was a mad night. And I was the one who got things jumping by going around collecting dimes and quarters from the rather stiff audience and coming back with three huge galleon jugs of California Burgundy and getting them all piffed so that by 11 o'clock when Alva Goldbook, Allen Ginsberg, was wailing his poem Wail, which is the poem Howl, drunk with arms outspread, everyone was yelling go, 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 like in a jazz jam session. Jaffe himself, Gary himself, read his fine poems about Coyote, the god of the Northwest Indians, Kwakutla and what all. And he had his tender lyrical lines and great mystery lines with barroom humor and his anarchistic ideas about how Americans don't know how to live. His voice was deep and resonant and somehow brave like the voice of old-time heroes and orators. Something earnest and strong and humanly hopeful I liked about him. While the other poets were either too dainty in their aestheticism, or too hysterically cynical to hope for anything, or too abstract and dindrosy, or too political, or just too incomprehensible. Kerouac's novel, The Dharma Bums, is very much a portrait of Gary Snyder, and we'll come to that book in a few moments. But here, in this poem, Migration of Birds, you have Snyder and Kerouac living together in a shack in Berkeley, California. April 1956, Migration of Birds. Started just now with a hummingbird hovering over the porch 2 yards away, then gone. It stopped me studying. I saw the redwood post leaned in clawed ground, tangled in a bush of yellow flowers higher than my head, through which we push every time we come inside. The shadow network of the sunshine through its vines. White-crowned sparrows make tremendous singings in the trees. The rooster down the valley crows and crows. Jack Kerouac outside behind my back reads the Diamond Sutra in the sun. Yesterday I read Migration of Birds, the Golden Plover and the Arctic Tern. Today that big abstraction's at our door. For juncos and the robins all have left. Broody scrabblers pick up bits of string. And in this hazy day of April summer heat, across the hill the seabirds chase spring north along the coast, nesting in Alaska in 6 weeks. Again, an awareness of the immediate context, all senses awake, the eyes and the ears being attracted by the presence of this hummingbird, it stopped me studying. It reminds me of there's an old Celtic poem, which was probably written on the island of Iona. It describes an old Celtic monk copying out psalms on a parchment. And at one time he must have been attracted by the sun shining through the window of the scriptorium, because in the margin of this old manuscript he scribbles in just his ordinary handwriting, not the fine handwriting used for transcribing the psalms. He scribbles, "How delightful to see the sunshine playing in the margin of this page." Well, Snyder is aware of the play of this hummingbird in the margin of his consciousness, and he turns towards it. I saw the redwood post, and there you have a whole conglomeration of details concerning this lush reality, tangled in a bush of yellow flowers higher than my head, through which we push every time we come inside. The shadow network of the sunshine through its vines, and then the birds. Jack Kerouac, they're both studying, they're both reading, they're both into books. Jack Kerouac is reading the Diamond Sutra, which is one of the main texts of Zen Buddhism, of Buddhism in general, and Zen Buddhism in particular, the Diamond Sutra. Notice that Snyder himself is not reading, although he knew more, a hell of a lot more about Buddhism than did Kerouac, especially at this time. He's reading a book on the migration of birds. In other words, he's further along the path. He's no longer reading the obvious texts. He's reading texts in which he can find an analogy for the Buddhist teaching. Don't forget that one of the main concepts in Buddhist teaching is the bird path. The bird path is the path of the mind gradually moving further and further towards its liberation. So he's reading Migration of Birds, a book on ornithology, not a book on Buddhist doctrine. He has the doctrine in his mind, if you like. Now he has to realize the reality in his body, in his life, and in the world around him. So he reads about the migration of birds rather than the obvious Buddhist text. The Golden Plover and the Arctic Tern. And again, not some mythological bird, not some symbolical bird, but real, live, specific birds. The Golden Plover and the Arctic Tern. To get detail into this context. Today, that big abstraction. However, migration is a huge abstraction, difficult to understand. Something happens in the world at one time, and the birds begin to move, just as the mind can suddenly begin to move into a big space, a big freedom space. Today, that big abstraction's at our door. For junkers and the robins all have left, broody scrabblers pick up bits of string, and in this hazy day of April summer heat, the language becomes even quieter and simpler in this, he's almost monosyllabic, in this hazy day of April summer heat. Across the hill, the seabirds chase spring north along the coast, nesting in Alaska in 6 weeks. After the tangle of details which he had in the middle of the poem, suddenly the poem opens out into this free, clean, breathing space, nesting in Alaska in 6 weeks. Alaska in 6 weeks. It's at one and the same time open and strong. You know, it's open because of all the A's, Alaska, and it's strong because of the S and the K and the W, 6 weeks. Huh? It's strong and open at the same time. Well, as I said, Kerouac's novel, The Dharma Bums, is very much a portrait of Gary Snyder. And this is how Kerouac sees Gary Snyder in general terms. He says, Snyder is a kid from Eastern Oregon. Okay, that's a purely biographical detail. And you have some more. From the beginning, a woods boy, a woodsman, an axeman, farmer, interested in animals and Indian lore. And he comes back on this idea that Snyder's a poet who doesn't look like a poet. He was the only one, when he met him in San Francisco, the only one who didn't look like a poet. Unlike, he says, certain horn-rimmed intellectual hipcats like Alva Goldbrook, and that's Allen Ginsberg. Snyder, not only does he not look like a poet, but he doesn't look like a bohemian. He doesn't try to come on as some bohemian of the arts, some kind of hanger-oner around the real work of poetry and art. No. He comes across as absolutely ordinary in his appearance. His clothes, for example, are old hand-me-downs bought second-hand in Goodwill and Salvation Army stores. And Kerouac runs through his intellectual biography. He became an Oriental scholar, while always remaining a mountain goat, a mountain goat. Snyder's very much a man in love with mountains, and moving into the mountains, as we'll see in a few poems later on, is part of his life practice, part of his meditation practice. One of his heroes is John Muir. John Muir, this Scotsman who emigrated to the States in the 19th century and who was instrumental in the foundation of the system of the national parks, Yosemite and so on, and who wrote beautiful books on, for example, the California mountains. John Muir then is one of Snyder's culture heroes. John Muir, M-U-I-R. Another aspect of Snyder that Kerouac is aware of and that he appreciates is his anarchistic ideas. Being a Northwest boy with idealistic tendencies, he got interested in old-fashioned IWW anarchism. Old American anarchism. So you have in Gary Snyder a juxtaposition, a coalescence, a meeting place of poetry, scholarship, American backcountry reality, and social radicalism. Poetry, scholarship, backcountry reality, and social radicalism. And Kerouac says, this is a tremendous little guy. Really the wildest, craziest, sharpest cat we've ever met. Potentially, says Kerouac, who was always sort of putting out the big phrase, a new hero of American culture. Kerouac then goes on to describe how Snyder lived in San Francisco. Describes his room, if you like, or his cabin. And the description of the room, of course, is also the description of a mind. Inside, he says, Kerouac, I saw the beautiful simplicity of Jaffe's way of living, neat, sensible, strangely rich, without a cent having been spent on the decoration. Old clay jars exploded with bouquets of flowers picked around the yard. His books were neatly stacked in orange crates. The floor was covered with inexpensive straw mats, the walls lined in burlap. From the burlap wall hung beautiful prints of old Chinese silk paintings and maps of Marin County and Northwest Washington, and various poems he'd written, and just stuck up on a nail for anybody to read. A beautiful simplicity, a neatness, a sensitivity, a juxtaposition of Chinese paintings and maps of the local territory. To write these poems that Kerouac saw on the walls of Snyder's room, on his cabin, Snyder tended to shoulder his rucksack, hence the term rucksack revolution. He would shoulder his rucksack, leave the cities, San Francisco in particular, and move up into the mountains, move into the back country, move out into the wilderness. Use all these words. Specifically, that meant the wood, the forest and mountain areas of North California and Washington. That's to say, Mount Baker National Forest, the North Cascades, or Glacier Peak Wilderness area, etc. Backcountry, primitive areas, wilderness. And in these areas, he would have no specific place to go, he would just drift. Get into the drift. Try and get into the drift of things. Let things drift in order to come into touch with a larger reality. Hitch north all of Washington, he says in one of his poems. Hitch north all of Washington, crossing and recrossing the passes, blown like dust, no place to work. Till perhaps somewhere, someplace, sometime, he finds a place, an attractive place, a useful place, and a job that will give him enough to live on, and at the same time, leave his mind free to think about other things. He'll tend to, in his jobs, to take up solitary occupations. And these solitary occupations would either mean forestry, working in the depths of some forest, or else working as fire lookout, again in the forests, living up on the top of some hill, alone for weeks, for months, as a fire guard. And there, in these places, in these contexts, he would undertake what he called the real work. The real work. And that's what comes across in this poem, this short poem, mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Here he is then, working as a lookout at a fire station in the mountains of Sourdough. Mid-August at Sourdough Mountain Lookout. Down Valley of Smoke Haze. 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows in the fir cones. Across rocks and meadows, swarms of new flies. I can't remember things I once read, a few friends, but they're in cities. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup. Looking down for miles through high, still air. Okay, again, absolutely simple language, almost monosyllables right through, almost. Especially in the first stanza, practically all monosyllables. Absolutely simple language then, describing a radical situation. A radical situation simply expressed, a clear vision of reality with no psychological blockages, no symbolical wanderings, no confused thinking. Down Valley of Smoke Haze, 3 days heat after 5 days rain, even numerically exact, 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows in the fir cones, the eye aware of the slightest details, pitch glows in the fir cones, that's the immediate detail, and then across rocks and meadows, swarms of youth flies, a wider perspective. Then he turns into his own mind, he looks at his own mind. I can't remember things I once read. There comes a time when you may forget all your reading, you go back to it, to augment your sense of reality. You plunge into reality, then you come back to reading. It's a sort of dialectical process. I can't remember things I once read. A few friends. Friends are there, but on the outskirts, because these friends live in cities. And cities, in this context, suddenly seem unreal. A few friends, but they are in cities. And then you have a kind of almost a little haiku, this very, very small Japanese poem which describes a neat situation, at the same time opening up a space of meditation, drinking cold snow water from a tin cup, looking down for miles through high, still air, drinking cold snow water, an absolutely radical freshness, cold snow water, from a tin cup, no fancy symbolism, a tin cup, the absolutely ordinary means are used. This is the extraordinary via the ordinary. Nothing extraordinary with a capital E. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup, opening up this space of clarity, looking down for miles through high, still air. A high emptiness, if you like. High was a word that was used very much in the 50s and 60s. You know, usually in the drug culture, to be high. I forget who said that the thing, in fact, is never just to be high, but to know how to be neat when you're high. And there is in this poem, as well as a highness, as well as an altitude of mind and living, there is a neatness, there is an organization, there is a concentration. Down valley of smoke haze, 3 days heat after 5 days rain. Pitch glows in the fir cones. Across rocks and meadows, swarms of new flies. I can't remember things I once read. A few friends, but they're in cities. Drinking cold snow water from a tin cup. Looking down for miles through high, still air. Thoreau, Henry Thoreau, way back in the 19th century, described in the following terms what he considered to be the real work, what he considered real work to be. And Thoreau described it this wise. He said that settle ourselves, it consists in settling ourselves and working and wedging our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place which we can call reality. Settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion, through opinions, through secondary realities, through the mud and slush, till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place. So you get right down to rock bottom ground. That we can call reality. And it's from there that you can really begin to do your dance, do your thinking, live your life. Settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place, which we can call reality. Rocks in place and reality leads us directly to a poem of Gary Snyder's called Rip Rap. Rip Rap, which is very much an ars poetica, an art poétique. But in fact, Rip Rap, the poem isn't called ars poetica or art poétique. It uses a forestry term. Rip Rap is a term used by lumbermen. And it describes a certain action which consists in planting rocks on a path. This is a mountain path. Ponies are going to have to move up the mountain, and so that the ponies will have some hold on the ground, muddy ground sometimes in the rainy season, so that they won't slip on the path. Rocks are placed on the path so that the ponies' hooves can get a grip. That's called rip-wrapping. Rip-wrapping. You rip-wrap the path. And of course, this rip-wrapping, which is a concrete, ordinary, everyday activity, in Snyder's mind, is going to become an analogy for poem making or for the poetic activity. Rip rap. Lay down these words before your mind like rocks. Place solid by hands and choice of place. Set before the body of the mind in space and time. Solidity of bark, leaf for wall, rip rap of things. Cobble of Milky Way, straying planets, these poems, people, lost ponies with dragging saddles and rocky, sure-foot trails. The world's like an endless, four-dimensional game of Go. Ants and pebbles in the thin loam, Each rock a word, a creek-washed stone, granite ingrained with torment of fire and weight, crystal and sediment linked hot, all change in thoughts as well as things. Lay down these words before your mind like rocks. The rocks now are words. Rocks, path, words, mind. Lay down these words before your mind like rocks. Place solid by hands in choice of place. You must place your words solidly if you want to write a real poem. Place them solidly. Place solid by hands in choice of place. Set before the body of the mind. It's an almost paradoxical phrase, the body of the mind. The mind, not as something abstracted from, separate from, divided from physicality, but the mind as having its own physicality, the body of the mind, in space and time. He's opening up the context. Setting words then in space and time. Solidity of bark. And the words are going to refer to things. Bark, leaf, a wall, rip-rap of things. But not only things under your feet, as it were, bark, leaf, or wall, but also things in the whole cosmic context, the cobble of Milky Way, strange planets. These are also part of the real context. Cobble of Milky Way. Cobble of Milky Way, notice. The Milky Way seen in the sky as if it was cobblestones on the street. No separation between the high and the low, the concrete and the abstract, the heavenly and the earthly. Cobble and Milky Way, straying planets. These poems, people, lost ponies with dragging saddles. People being lost, like ponies, lost ponies with dragging saddles. People are lost in their minds, confused, erratic. They can get, however, onto a rocky sure-foot trail. The world's like an endless four-dimensional game of Go, but it's not easy. The world is like this game of Go, this Chinese game Go, which is a very complex game of movements and strategies. The world's like an endless four-dimensional, not only three-dimensional, but four-dimensional game of Go. Ants and pebbles in a thin loam, each rock a word. Things then, and words referring to things, but words that have to be cleansed, cleaned. Each word like a creek-washed stone. To clean your vocabulary, creek washed stone, to keep your words as clean and as hard and as shining as granite. Granite, which is a rock arising from the collaboration of fire and mass, with torment of fire and weight. You have this terrific conglomeration of matter, this terrific pressure of forces, which gives rise to this rock. Granite, crystal and sediment linked hot, crystal and sediment, basic reality, basic earth and crystallized earth, linked hot, all change in thoughts as well as things. Remember we saw Robinson Jeffers last week saying that he would concern himself with things and things and things and have no more thoughts. Here you have Snyder saying you cannot simply abstract thought. You must also have change in your thoughts. All change in thoughts as well as things. So it's a direct reference to Robinson Jeffers with a little step forward or a little step aside, if you like. Lay down these words before your mind like rocks. Place solid by hands in choice of place. Set before the body of the mind in space and time. Solidity of bark, leaf or wall, rip-rap of things. Cobble of Milky Way, straying planets, these poems, people, lost ponies with dragging saddles and rocky sure-foot trails. The world's like an endless four-dimensional game of Go. Ants and pebbles in a thin loam, each rock a word, a creek-washed stone, granite ingrained with torment of fire and weight, crystal and sediment linked hot, all change in thoughts as well as things. Poetry for Snyder, that's the real work, and the poem should be, in Snyder's estimation, the phenomenal world, I'm quoting him, the phenomenal world experienced at certain pitches. The phenomenal world, the world of phenomena, the world of things, the phenomenal world experienced at certain pitches. Phenomenon is what surges up into the consciousness, what surges before the mind. The phenomenal world experienced at certain pitches. It should be an experience, and he uses the word divine, totally divine, exciting, mysterious, filling one with a trembling awe, leaving one grateful and humble. The wonder of the mystery returns direct to one's senses and consciousness. Inside and outside, the voice breathes, ah. Inside and outside. This meeting of the inside with the outside that we saw in Wallace Stevens, for example. Inside and outside, the voice breathes, ah. Ah. That's part of Japanese aesthetics, by the way. The ultimate in Japanese aesthetics is what is called the ah feeling. Ah feeling. There's a, you can hardly call it a poem, but there's a phrase by the Japanese poet Matsuo Basho, who at one time made a trip up to the north of Japan, a trip up north, as we saw earlier on in Gary Snyder. And at one point, he's confronted by the islands of Matsushima, the Pine Islands, on the Pacific coast of Japan. And instead of, you know, writing a poem about the Pine Islands, about Matsushima, he simply says this, Matsushima, ah, ah, Matsushima, Matsushima, ah. Snyder calls this the inner song of the self and of the planet. The inner song of the self and of the planet. A kind of planet self. Little distinction between the planet and yourself. We saw him in that poem saying, I've forgotten things I once read. That happens, and it has to happen. As I say, there's a kind of dialectical process. You read, you place yourself in a reality where you tend to forget what you're reading, then you come back to reading and so on. And Snyder, in fact, has read a hell of a lot. He's read a great deal, and his books, the books he read were, well, among the books he read were the following. This is by no means a complete list, obviously. But among the books he read would be, or were, Patanjali's Yoga System. Patanjali, P-A-T-A-N-J-A-L-I, Patanjali, his Yoga System, the book on yoga. Yoga as being the practice which should result in some kind of composition, some kind of uniting of the self, first of all, and then secondly, of the self with the world, the universe, the cosmos, call it what you like. Patanjali's Yoga System. Another book he read, and not only read, but studies, is Huang Po, Chinese book, Huang Po, H-U-A-N-G, Huang, and then Po, P-O, Huang Po's Doctrine of Universal Mind. Doctrine of Universal Mind. Universal Mind, a mind free of merely ego blockages, free of confused thinking, obviously. Another book he read, there's an Indian book, a Chinese book, now a Japanese book, the Sutra of Huineng, Huineng Sutra, H-U-I-N-E-N-G. So Indian, Chinese, and Japanese books. But not only that, these are the Oriental studies, but he was reading also English literature. He was reading Chaucer. Chaucer, why Chaucer? I think because of Chaucer's racy style, his fast style, without any redundancy, without any encumbrance. A pithy English, a pithy, strong, direct English. And because also what you find in Chaucer, which is the folk thing, the interest in folk, in people, the group thing, the folk thing. He's reading Blake, William Blake. Why Blake? There, I think it's for, well, the famous phrase by William Blake, if we could cleanse the doors of perception, we would really see the world clearly. To cleanse the doors of perception. Clean the perception, clean the mind, clean the eyes, the ears, the senses. He's also reading Milton. Not that Snyder in any way shares a Christian ideology, a Christian doctrine, theory, belief. But maybe the idea of paradise. But maybe paradise on earth rather. Because Snyder does not believe, you know, in paradise as an afterlife or an after earth. No paradise, he says, no fall. Only the weathering land, the wheeling sky. That's one of his poems. No paradise, no fall. Only the weathering land, the wheeling sky. Everything happens on this earth. Other books he's reading, these are, okay, you have books on yoga and on Buddhism. You have books of literature and poetry. And you also have books on geology, the sheer physical basic reality of the earth in which we live and which we try to live, geology, astronomy, and ornithology, as we've already seen. They attempt to get towards a clear, attentive mind and a full presence in the world. They attempt to achieve a new grounding on the earth. Snyder liked to quote an Indian poem, Haida, H-A-I-D-A. It's one of the Northwest tribes, Kwakutl, Haida, Tsimshian, and so on. There's a Haida poem which says this, and I think it's a question for everybody to ask himself, herself. Is it real? Is it real, this life I am living? Is it real? Is it real, this life I am living? In a book which I don't think was part of Snyder's bookshelves, which might have been, a book by a man called Friedhof Schoen, called Image de l'Esprit. You have Schoen, you don't have to accept all of Schoen's ideas, but I simply refer to this one. He speaks of the loss of primordial intelligence in the modern mind. The loss of primordial intelligence. He says the modern mind, the civilized mind, is supersaturated with fictitious constructions. And he says the symbolic vision of the cosmos, based on knowledge of virgin nature, that sanctuary, the keys to which the West has lost since the disappearance of the mythologies. Well, Snyder is trying to get back to that primordial intelligence, trying to get away from fictitious constructions in the mind, trying to get back to a grounding. In this, he was in a line of writers, thinkers, poets, existentials, poet existentials, like, for example, D.H. Lawrence, whom we'll come to very soon. D.H. Lawrence, interested in primitivism, interested in Amerindian culture. Somebody else trying to get back to a certain grounding, Yeats in Ireland, whom we'll come to also. Yeats saying, have not all races had their first unity from a mythology that marries them to rock and hill? Antonin Artaud, to move from nation to nation, Antonin Artaud in France, in his book Voyage au pays des Tarahumaras, the same thing, looking for a grounding. In France also, Georges Bataille, saying that modern man was concerned with the rational mastery of the universe, whereas what he calls desertic man, l'homme du désert, desertic man, was concerned with a dream of the universe, not a rational mastery of the universe, but a dream of the universe. You could say that Hart Crane was trying for the same thing. Hart Crane speaking of the primal world of the Indian and speaking of its mythical and smoky soil. And also Robinson Jeffers, who is Guy Snyder's immediate culture ancestor, if you like, speaking of his desire to see the people fewer and the hawks more numerous. While Snyder moves away from what he calls the crazed hooked nations, and moves into a primal territory, that primal territory that the men we've mentioned were after. Whitman also, when he says the poets of the cosmos advanced to first principles. Melville, when he spoke of getting through to prime. This primitive living, or this primal living, if primitive has too many pejorative connotations, this primal living meant to Snyder's mind, and that's what he was after, a sharpness and an acuteness of life. It's that that he tried to get from his studies in Indian culture, and will continue with this exploration and experience of Indian culture next week.